Hey, it's Todd Stacey, and welcome to In the Weeds with Alabama Daily News. Our guest this week is Congressman Mo Brooks. Mr. Brooks, of course, represents the 5th District of Alabama, the northernmost district that contains the city of Huntsville. I've really been looking forward to releasing this podcast because I found this interview with Mr. Brooks really fascinating. My apologies for taking so long to do it. They're kind of time-consuming to put together. And the reason why is, you know, Mr. Brooks is well known as being one of the most outspoken members of Congress, probably the most outspoken, at least of our delegation. And that's on a slew of conservative issues, but really the one that stands out is immigration. He has had some of the toughest, sharpest, strongest rhetoric against illegal immigration that you'll find really from anybody. And that's saying something, because there's a lot of people in Congress that you know, talk a lot about that issue. The reason why it's newsworthy and relevant right now is that Congressman Brooks has been flirting with the idea of running for Senate in 2020. Of course, Congressman Bradley Byrne has already thrown his name in the hat. We played his interview a few weeks ago. He's out there. He's announced. He's raising money. He's, you know, really trying to build all the support he can. Nobody else has officially announced. There was thought that Gary Palmer might get in, Congressman. Gary Palmer, there's thought that Roy Moore could again get in this race, and why not? There's even talk about Governor Robert Bentley, former Governor Robert Bentley, getting in. So the stage is not completely set as far as the Senate race goes, but for Mo Brooks to even think about getting in the race is pretty significant. Part of this comes from Club for Growth, and of course, Club for Growth is a Washington, D.C. based group that raises money and promotes candidates that they like and are comfortable with. And they're ostensibly a very conservative group, although I'd argue that on issue to issue. But they can have a strong voice, and they can raise a bunch of money to not necessarily give to a candidate. They may or may not do that. What they can do is start an issue advocacy campaign that promotes a candidate without actually coordinating with them, and that can be, or attacking another candidate, which is probably the even more effective thing to do. So they, you know, it really could matter in a race like this. And they don't seem to be in love with Bradley Byrne, and so they've been basically coaxing other candidates to get into the race with kind remarks, saying nice things. And in this case, they released some polling. A Club for Growth poll surveyed 501 likely Republican voters 2 weeks ago, and it showed Mo Brooks leading in a three-way race between Bradley Byrne, Roy Moore, and himself. So this poll showed Brooks at 31%, Moore at 25%, and Byrne at 25%. Now, of course, this is way early in the race, and what kind of polling really matters right now, it doesn't. But it does show that he has a lot of good name ID. He, of course, ran last time during the special election for Senate and came up short to Luther Strange and Roy Moore, who went to that runoff. But just being out there has, you know, has benefited him. But the race won't be that small. You know, the field won't be just four or three candidates. It's likely to be a lot bigger. And so that same poll, when adding in additional candidates like Del Marsh, Secretary of State John Merrill, State Auditor Jim Ziegler, when you added those names in, Brooks' lead gets a lot smaller, and the differences between those top-tier candidates fall within the margin of error, which is 4.4%, plus or minus 4.4%. So the question is this polling, which was positive for Brooks, you can argue about the methodology, you can argue about, you know, how early it is, things like that, but it showed Brooks in a positive light. Is it enough to coax him into running? You know, I've talked with several people in Washington and in Alabama who say they're familiar with his thinking, and he says he really has not changed his position either way. Of course, I talked to him about this one-on-one, which you'll hear in a second, about running for the Senate, and he went into it. You know, he certainly said he had not ruled it out. He called it, at that time, very unlikely. But he talked a lot about what it would mean to be in the Senate versus the frustration sometimes that comes from the House, just from a lack of authority to really accomplish things. He has about $692,000 cash on hand. I'm told he could probably have another 130. That's not bad. You know, that's getting near the 900 million dollar mark, which, I mean, that's what you need really to launch a Senate bid. So at least he's got some in the bank. He's been very frugal and not spent that money over the years. Comparatively, Bradley Byrne ended last year with about $1 million. You know, the question is whether Bradley Byrne will be able to raise the kind of money. He's traditionally been a very good fundraiser. So if he puts up a $500,000, $750,000 quarter, which we'll have here in about a week, that would be a strong quarter. And how much money Bradley raises might influence whether or not Mo gets in the race. Of course, you've got other names like Lieutenant Governor Will Ainsworth, who everybody kind of talks about because of his big win this past time. And Lee Busby, the guy, the Tuscaloosa Marine, who waged a write-in campaign against Roy Moore and Doug Jones, finding both unacceptable. And he's thinking about entering the fray. So anyway, the point is Mo Brooks is at least considering this, which I found very interesting. And we talked a little bit about it. But that's the least of what you should be interested in as far as this interview goes. I talked with Mo about his passion on the immigration issue, both on sort of details of what he believes, but also I'm interested in how do you go about selecting issues as, okay, I'm really going to go full bore on this. And how do you go about marshaling the information that you say, man, I'm going to go to the House floor and just rail on this thing. How does that process work? Everybody knows that Mr. Brooks is outspoken and can just go off on a subject. But take me behind the scenes, how that process starts. And I think you'll find that exchange really interesting. I talked to him about representing Huntsville and North Alabama and what a federal town that is, federal area really, with Redstone and NASA and so many defense contractors in there, how the government shutdown, the longest government shutdown, affected them, and what his feedback was. I found that really interesting, as well as sort of that narrative of it being a federal town and whether that's fair. I talked to him really candidly about fundraising on Capitol Hill. Something he, finds distasteful. But not just that, he connected it to committee chairmanships and kind of climbing the hill as far as building influence. You'll find those very candid remarks interesting, and really just the whole gamut. He's obviously a very passionate person, and in our, I guess it was about a 30-minute conversation, he never once relented a single point. And here, it's just me. I'm not the New York Times. It's just little old me, and he was as relentless as I've ever seen him, as if he was talking to, meet the press. So anyway, I found it very interesting. I hope you will too. Here's Mo Brooks. Hey, Congressman, how are you doing?
Afternoon.
Thanks for having me in the office. You've changed offices. This is different than where I remember you being. You've got a different view of it.
That's right. When you get enough seniority, you can actually look out and see them all. Unfortunately, I don't have enough seniority to only see them all. I see a fraction of it.
Well, you've got the botanical garden there.
That's so it.
That's pretty nice. Let's jump right in and talk about immigration, an issue you're obviously passionate about. Do you think President Trump ultimately gets all of the border wall money, and do you think he actually gets to build the wall?
President Trump has already been authorized to spend money on wall construction, and that money has been appropriated. So he can travel under one statute, if my memory serves me correctly, it's 10 U.S.C. 284, that has about $1 billion that is a start on a wall. It's not all the way from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean, but it's a start on a substantial wall. And then he's got other statutes that authorize the president to declare a national emergency, and clearly 50 Americans dead per day, minimal estimate, from the lack of border security, that is an emergency.
Whose estimate is that? I've not heard that stat.
Well, it probably a more accurate estimate is in the neighborhood of 100 to 150 dead per day. But that is federal government data.
You've got Homeland or BLS or somebody like that?
Well, I'll give you the specifics, and you can look it up on the internet because it's all over the place if you know where to
hunt. Because you told specific stories from Huntsville a couple of weeks ago.
Well, let me give you the details. You've got, according to federal government law enforcement data, over 2,000 illegal aliens were apprehended by federal agents in fiscal year 2018 for homicides, killing other people, all on American soil. So that's roughly seven per day who are dead as a result of homicides committed by illegal aliens. Then you've got drugs and drug overdoses, which come through our poor southern border, much of which is transported throughout the United States by illegal aliens and the drug cartels. Just heroin alone is roughly 16,000 dead Americans each year from drug overdoses, and it is estimated by the federal government's law enforcement agencies that roughly 90% of that heroin is transported illegally across our poor southern border. Then you've got other drugs like cocaine and fentanyl that combined are 20 plus thousand dead per year. And that's not even included in that 50 dead per day that I talk about because of homicides by illegal aliens and a southern border that is so porous that drug cartels and other criminal elements are transporting huge quantities of poisonous, death-dealing drugs.
You've said that you support him declaring a national emergency. I mean, you just did.
Well, think about this for a second, okay? How many people died that caused us to invade Iraq and Afghanistan? Roughly 3,000 on 9/11. 2001. 3,000. We have easily five times that killed each year because of illegal aliens and our poor southern border. If 3,000 dead with some property damage is enough to cause the United States of America to go to war on foreign soil, wars that to some degree or another continue to this day, well, shouldn't 15,000 plus qualify as a national emergency? I think it's a no-brainer. The answer is yes.
Let me ask you about that. Should the say he does declare a national emergency, because everybody I talk to says it's pretty likely at some point, maybe not tonight, maybe tomorrow, who knows.
He should have done it 2 years ago.
Well,
but he's been very patient with the Democrats, and I believe his patience is wearing thin, and we need to stop relying on the Democrats to support border security because they don't believe in it. They're never going to do it. They're going to mouth the words, but they're not going to support it.
Should it be just the border, or could you see a national emergency also involving, I mean, you mentioned Afghanistan. Well, I mean, we went there. Do we need to go to Guatemala? Do we need to go to Honduras and do something? Do we need to change the dynamic that is causing some of this, the people who are coming?
Perhaps people can advance an argument to that effect. I'm not advancing that argument.
Okay.
My argument is we need to secure our southern border. We need to stop illegal aliens from coming into our country. We need to stop the damage that they're doing. We also need to stop, to a much better degree than we have been doing, the poisonous drugs that are coming into our country. Collectively, over 70,000 Americans died last year from drug overdoses. Now, not all of those drugs come from our southern border, so you have to limit that 70,000. I think a reasonable estimate just off the cuff would probably be in the 30, 35, 40,000 range of dead Americans due to drug trafficking across our poor southern border. My minimal estimate of 50 dead Americans per day is just based on heroin's 15 to 16,000 plus the 2,000 illegal alien homicides. So that's when I say it's a minimal estimate of 50, I think that's a safe number, but the actual number is probably far in excess of that. Unfortunately, we don't have the data collection ability to give an exact number.
Are we ever going to have an agreement on Homeland Security funding from this day forward? I mean, it just seems like, I mean, Pelosi is absolutely dug in, the president's absolutely dug in. How do you govern if you just can't agree?
the socialists prefer open borders, so they're going to do everything they can to thwart border security. And I don't use the word socialists whimsically. The Democrats have morphed into the Socialist Party. And by way of example, there was a Gallup poll done not that long ago where 57% of self-identified Democrats stated that they preferred socialism over free enterprise and capitalism. So they have become the Socialist Party of America. But I don't see the socialists ever supporting border security as Americans understand the phrase border security. And the reason for that is a craving for political power. The Socialist Democrats have figured out that open borders ultimately result in large numbers of foreigners who are not familiar with our foundational principles in America, who aren't necessarily familiar with the distinction between free enterprise and socialism, and who are overwhelmingly dependent on welfare for their livelihoods. You put all that together, and as amnesty is given, or as votes occur illegally, or as children grow up in those households, they are reliable Democrat voters. And the Democrats have seen that strategy work in California, which not that long ago, many decades, but not that long ago, historically speaking, was a Republican state. Now, out of 53 congressmen, seven are Republican, 46 are Democrat. That's why California is a sanctuary state. The Democrats have figured that the best way to grab power is not by changing the minds of American citizens, it's by importing illegally or otherwise foreigners who can be depended on to vote Democrat, thereby diluting the votes of American citizens. That's their big game plan strategy. That's why they're fighting so hard to promote that strategy by opening up our borders.
You are one of, if not the most outspoken members of Congress on the immigration issue, but on a lot of issues. But what I'm interested in is kind of how you go about that process. I mean, is there a strategy behind, you know, I mean, we're just sitting here talking right now, and you have rattled off more statistics than most congressmen typically would. You're obviously well read on it and well rehearsed, and you know your stuff, and you're relentless when you're delivering that. And we could go to another issue. You did the same thing. I've seen you over the years. I mean, you're really relentless at delivering it. Is there a strategy behind that? What's the end game with just driving that message home the way you do rhetorically?
The end game is to try to protect America's future from disaster. With socialism versus free enterprise, by way of example, if we succumb to the siren call of socialism, the end result is going to be a devastated economy and the loss of millions of American lives. For example, what happens when the central government goes insolvent or bankrupt, which is where we are headed because of socialist attitudes of the Democrats and also because of our deficit and debt situation? When we go bankrupt, all of a sudden there's not money for Medicare. There's not money for Medicaid. We don't have the money when you're on a cash basis to pay for our national security or national defense. You don't have the money to pay for food stamps or other food delivery mechanisms for our poor. You don't have the money to do so many different things that help support the lives of Americans. And so look at Venezuela. Look at Greece to a lesser degree. Look at Argentina when it went through this process. There are a lot of South American countries that have gone through an insolvency and bankruptcy with hyperinflation. Look at Italy, and they're not there yet, but they're headed in that direction. Look at Puerto Rico, which defaulted on $73 billion in debt, and the net effect was they were not able to protect their own citizens from a regular occurrence such as hurricanes. You know, they didn't have food supplies, water supplies, and depots spread throughout the island, which a wise government would have had. They did not harden their utilities so that you would be able to withstand hurricane-force winds. And a lot of bad things happen when a central government goes insolvent. So that's what I'm trying to do, is to promote the foundational principles that for the last 75 years have made America the greatest nation in world history. And I'm having to do it in the face of greedy, selfish interests who think more about themselves rather than their country. And there are a lot of those people here on Capitol Hill.
I was going to ask you, does it frustrate you that there? I mean, I'd say maybe most folks, not just in Congress, but just surrounding this complex, don't share your passion for that.
It is unfortunate but true that if you're in the House or the Senate, you have very limited time. And a lot of people in the House and the Senate, by way of example, spend that time raising money for their next election, purchasing that ammo that you want to fire in the next campaign. I don't raise that much money. Instead, what I try to do is spend my time studying, doing my homework on public policy issues so that I have a better understanding of what is right and what is wrong. Not just the surface effect, but also the long-term cascading effects on our country. And then that's what I advocate. And there are a number of foundational principles that are under threat right now. By foundational principles, I'm talking about the principles that help combine to make America a great nation. Freedom, which is the premise of free enterprise and capitalism, that's huge in our prosperity. You've got the fact that we're a republic. We get to select our leaders. That's huge. So as a consequence, we ought to be opposed to anything that promotes voter fraud, that undermines the ability of American citizens to control our country's own fate. You've got moral values. It's one thing to have great power. It's another thing to do the wrong thing with it. Nazi Germany, imperialist Japan, they had great power in the 1940s, but they didn't have the moral compass to help them do the right thing. And our moral values are under huge assault on a daily basis by the no-brain national news media and by Democrats who on a regular basis promote selfishness and greed rather than self-sacrifice. It kind of brings to my mind President Kennedy, and one of his most famous quotes was, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." There's not a Democrat living on Capitol Hill right now in the House or the Senate that adheres to President Kennedy's admonition of the 1960s. And that is a dead-end path for our country, but that is a part of the Democrat strategy to win elections. They've basically got three themes. One is create racism, create racial division, and then exploit it. That's bad. That's dividing us as a country based on skin pigmentation, ethnicity, factors we have no control over. But the Democrats engage in racism on a regular basis. A second major theme is gender animosity. Vote for me because of my sex. Well, the last time I checked, public policy doesn't care what your sex is. Public policy cares about the outcome of the laws that you enact. That's what's important, not someone's chromosomes. And then the third theme that the Democrats have is who would you rather vote for, Santa Claus or the Grinch? And so the Democrats try to set it up in a socialist mindset that we're going to give you everything so you'll become more dependent on the government for your livelihood. And that dependency is a form of slavery. That's the exact opposite of what made America great. Yet that's where socialists are taking us now on Capitol Hill with Bernie Sanders, with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, with almost every single Democrat in the House and the Senate. That is their mindset now. And so if we're going to save our country, people have to better understand, they have to better do their homework, they need to understand the net effects of these public policy issues, or else we're going to lose our democracy, lose our republic, as was warned by a political philosopher by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1800s. His most famous observation about America was that we were doomed to fail, and we would fail the moment a majority of the voters realized that they could use the power of the government, the point of a gun, to seize other people's property to give to themselves, which is where Elizabeth Warren in the last few weeks has says she wants to take us, that she wants to have a tax on how much you own in America, your wealth, and seize it from you. What's the moral value there, where the government, at the point of a gun, under threat of going to jail, under threat of seizure of your property, now can confiscate your property that you have earned to give to others who have not seized the opportunities that we offer in a free society like America?
How do you walk me through how you go about selecting that issue to just go full bore on? I mean, it can't be everything. You can't go, you know, full bore on, you know, I guess, what is it, to a hammer, everything's a nail, but I mean, you. What do? You read? Do you study issues? Do you hear from staff? What's your process in going through and saying, this is it? This is the one that I'm going to focus on this week or this year or whatever?
Well, ultimately, the issues I focus on in a general sense are based on almost a lifetime of study. I was a high school debater on two championship debate teams at Grissom High School in Huntsville, Alabama. I went to Duke University, majored in political science and economics, double major in 3 years, and also took public policy study classes along with being on the debate team for two of the years that I was there. Then as an attorney, you learn the law and you learn the cascading effects of different statutes and how they affect people who are your clients or otherwise. Then I've been in the state legislature, a county commissioner, a district attorney on the law enforcement side, so I see how the Democrats' soft on crime policies actually make things worse by increasing crime, by creating more victims, and then in the United States Congress. So all of that, and all the reading that goes with it, the study that goes with it, has helped form my belief system, and I try to focus on the major threats. There are a lot of threats to America going forward, but the biggest threats are deficit and debt. By way of example, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, at least two of them, have now publicly testified before the House Armed Services Committee that the greatest national security threat facing our country is our deficit and debt, because it has the ability to strip us of our ability to defend ourselves by not having enough money to pay for a national defense. So these are experts in military history defining for us on the House Armed Services Committee what the greatest threat is, national security threat is, to the United States of America. They didn't say Russia, they didn't say China, they didn't say the Islamic State, they didn't say Iran, they didn't say North Korea, they said deficit and debt. Then you've got border security, which also has an adverse effect on deficit and debt because the net tax loss is roughly $116 billion a year at the city, county, state, local level. Illegal aliens generate about $20 billion in tax revenue, but they consume about $136 billion in taxes. So that's also bad for local and state governments. It's also bad for our deficit and debt. And in a major way, it has the ability to change the electorate, which in turn increases the power of socialists, and socialism is a dead-end path. That's the difference between socialism and free enterprise. So you've got just those three. They interrelate with each other, and they all can have a major adverse effect on America's future. So I fight them. Now, which one I bring up at any particular time depends on what the media tends to focus on or what I believe needs to be stated in order to grab public attention.
You've got two TVs going. I see one CNN, one Fox News. So are you, you're kind of watching both all day long?
Not all day long. I do have them on, and I will occasionally turn up the volume. Right now, as you know, they're both on mute.
Help you? If something big is happening, you're going to know about it because it's
that, yeah. That helps. Okay. And often one of them is on C-SPAN, which might be the House or Senate floor debate. So I know what's being said by my colleagues. You folks in the media have a way of deciding on a moment's notice what it is we should be answering questions about. And it's good to know if something has just happened, like the Virginia governor's statement last week, I think it was on Friday, that he supports infanticide, the killing of living children after childbirth. For a Democrat to do that is just an abomination.
Switching gears, you ran for Senate. I believe you said you're not going to do it this time.
I have not said
you've
that.
Not said that. Okay.
I've said it is highly unlikely that I will run for the Senate in 2020.
Fair enough.
Possible, but highly unlikely.
All right. Well, that was going to be my question, is if it wasn't this year, could you see yourself doing that another time? Or, I mean, is the Senate really attractive to you still?
The big negative about a campaign for the Senate, or two of them. One is risk of loss, and the other is risk of success. With risk of loss, then your voice is to a large degree silenced. You're not able to advocate public awareness on deficit and debt, on border security, on socialized medicine, socialism versus free enterprise, any of those things. The risk of success is this. I have four wonderful children, three wonderful children-in-law, and they have blessed Martha, my wife, and I with 10 grandchildren who live within about 3 or 4 miles of my house. And if you're a United States Senator, to a certain degree, you're sacrificing your family life. I love my wife. I enjoy being with her. I enjoy being able to come home at night when I'm not in Washington and being in her company. Same thing with my kids and grandkids. So that's the risk of winning, is that you, to a certain degree, have divorced your family to some degree because of loss of time as you're all over the state.
Well, if it wasn't the Senate, what else do you want to accomplish here in the House? I mean, you actually just spoke earlier about kind of the mentality of hill climbing and, you know, fundraising and all that kind of stuff. But what's attractive to you here? Is there a committee chairmanship that you would want? Is there some role in Congress that you still want to accomplish in the House?
Well, committee chairmanships come at a price. You have to pay money to get them.
Okay.
And I have been offered chairmanships of a variety of subcommittees, and the asking price has typically been about $300,000.
This is fundraising, basically, the NRCC?
That is correct, okay. Where you need to pay a certain amount to the NRCC to be better positioned to be chairman or ranking member of certain subcommittees or committees. And I believe that corrupts the public policy debate, and so I do not participate in that mechanism. The citizens back home, by and large, they're not gazillionaires. They're not going to throw buckets fulls of cash at you. And so to get that kind of money, all too often you have to sell your vote to special interest groups who will give you the money in exchange for votes that may or may not be in the best interest of our country. And that kind of pressure to raise that kind of money to succumb to special interest groups by sacrificing America's interest, that's not me. I don't do that. Now, in terms of personal goals, my personal goals are national goals. If we can defend successfully free enterprise and defeat socialism, that's a huge victory for America. If we can have border security, that's a huge victory for America. If we can somehow or another get the American people to focus on deficit and debt so that America does not go insolvent and bankrupt, that's a huge victory for America. Unfortunately, right now, on all three of those issues, it looks like the best we've been able to do is a stalemate or a loss.
You represent a federal town. And fundraising aside, it probably would be very easy to be one of the top fundraisers in Congress representing all of what is in Huntsville. But beyond that, you represent a federal town, just went through the shutdown. Obviously, that was a painful... It was reportedly painful. I was going to ask you about that. What was the feedback? What did people tell you? Were they calling up here? Were they asking for things? Were you in touch with the not just the government folks, but those who were contracted and sort of dependent on that government, Redstone and everything else?
There were different levels of communication depending on who was doing the communicating. By and large, the general citizenry, including those who had been furloughed, were overwhelmingly in support of a border wall and better border security. I am very fortunate in that the federal workers that I have in the Tennessee Valley have a great love for country. The vast majority of those federal workers are in national defense, national security, where there's a lot of patriotism. Of course, we also have a major NASA base, Marshall Space Flight Center. They also have a love of country. And they are highly educated, and they understand the risk to America of open borders policies advocated by the Democrats. So, you know, I didn't keep the stats, but just in communications to me, I would say that it was probably 80 to 90% of the people who were furloughed or who were being ordered to work without pay who were for what President Trump was trying to do on border security. Hmm. Now, on the private sector side, the company executives that were worried about how they were going to make payroll with respect to space, not national defense, but space, they were much more concerned about how the shutdown was impacting their ability to take care of their employees. So they were much more likely to be asking me to end the shutdown as quick as possible. And of course, basically this shutdown was about an irresistible force versus an immovable object. You had Donald Trump on the one hand, who wants to protect and save the lives of Americans, and then you have the Democrats on the other hand, who are more than willing to sacrifice those lives of Americans in exchange for greater political power. And neither one of them, it looked like for a long period of time, were going to budge. But ultimately, the Democrats refused to compromise one iota. President Trump obviously budged, and the government was reopened without adequate security at the southern border.
I think we've got to go. I wanted to ask you one thing. Is that overblown, that narrative? Go ahead. We can edit this out. That narrative about Huntsville, federal town, you represent the federal town, that's a common narrative. Is that correct? Is that how it just impacts everything? It seems to be part of what the North Alabama 5th District narrative
National
is.
Defense and space are the two economic giants of the Tennessee Valley. So, yes, if the federal government catches a cold that adversely affects expenditures for national defense and for space, Tennessee Valley has the flu.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm sorry if we went over, but I look forward to having you on the podcast.
My pleasure. Look forward to doing it again.
Thank you.